Welcome and thank you for standing by. All participants are currently in a listen-only mode. To ask a question during the question and answer session, please press star 1. As a reminder, today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host, Ms. Alicia Downs. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and welcome to today's COCA conference call entitled Antiviral Resistance Among Influenza A, H1N1 Viruses, and Interim Guidance for Antivirals. We are very excited to have Dr. Anthony Fiore present on this call. Dr. Fiore is a senior medical epidemiologist in the influenza division within the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases here at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, Georgia. Dr. Fiore is going to cover a lot of information in this presentation, and we may go over time by just a few minutes. So if you don't get a chance to ask your question at the end of the call, please remember that you can email COCA at coca@cdc.gov, and we will work to get you a response. We are using a PowerPoint presentation for this call, and you should be able to access that from our website. If you have not already downloaded the presentation, please go to www.emergency.cdc.gov/COCA. Click on Conference Call Information Summaries and Slide Sets. The PowerPoint can be found there under the call-in number and passcode. The objectives for today's call. After this activity, the participants will be able to describe resistance patterns among influenza strains, recognize alternative antiviral treatment options when resistance is suspected, and identify ways to assess likelihood of resistance. In compliance with continuing education requirements, all presenters must disclose any financial or other relationships with the manufacturers of commercial products, suppliers of commercial services, or commercial supporters, as well as any use of unlabeled products or products under investigational use. CDC, our planners, and the presenters for the seminar do not have financial or other relationships with the manufacturers of commercial products, suppliers of commercial services, or commercial supporters. This presentation does not involve the unlabeled use of a product or product under investigational use, and there is no commercial support. I will now turn the call over to Dr. Fiore. You may begin.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to be in this call. This is a rapidly moving topic, especially in this season, and I think it's great to have an opportunity to update listeners to changes that have just been made in the antiviral recommendations guidance. And so without further ado, I'll launch right into it. I'm looking at my title slide now, which is Antiviral Resistance Among Influenza A Viruses and Interim Guidance for Use of Antivirals. And moving to the next slide, I've just provided you with a brief overview here. We need to do a little bit of background on influenza testing and treatment in order to make sense of the guidance. I was going to describe the current status of antiviral resistance in the United States, talk about the interim guidelines which came out in late December, and then provide you with some indication of what you might see later in the season as far as additional guidance, and provide a summary. Next slide, please. This slide is titled Human Influenza, and just a very brief background. It's a highly transmissible respiratory illness caused by influenza viruses. We, of course, have yearly winter epidemics, and often this is called seasonal influenza or interpandemic influenza. There are sporadic, unpredictable pandemics, which we won't discuss today. There are three strains of influenza viruses in circulation among humans at this point. There are two influenza A subtypes called H1N1 and H3N2, and this is fairly critical information for understanding the rest of the talk. And influenza B is the third type of influenza virus circulating in humans. So three different types, two subtypes of A and influenza B. Influenza A viruses mutate, or influenza B viruses do also, but A viruses do it more quickly, in two different ways. One is called antigenic drift, and one is called antigenic shift. Antigenic drift is a continual process. It involves point mutations or small recombinations within the viral genes. It results in a diminished immune response among those that have been previously infected or immunized because the virus is a little bit different the next time it shows up, and that's referred to, those strains are referred to as drifted strains. The result is that we have yearly epidemics, and that we have to update the vaccine yearly. But one other consequence of antigenic drift is that these changes can occur in the sites that the antivirals attach to, and the active sites, that is, and they can cause changes in susceptibility to the antivirals, just by the process of antigenic drift. Antigenic shift is a sporadic and unpredictable event. That's when an entire gene segment is replaced, the hemagglutinin gene or the neuraminidase gene, and these are sometimes derived from animal influenza A's. There's no immunity within the population. This is what results in a pandemic. It's not what we're talking about here, though. Next slide, please, which is entitled Annual Interpandemic Influenza Impact. Every year, 2.5% to 20% of the population become ill. The highest rates are in children, an average of 36,000 deaths, with over 90% of them among those greater than 64 years old. An average of over 200,000 hospitalizations each year, but there's a wide range from year to year. About 50 to 60% of those are in people over the age of 64. The risk of hospitalization, however, for children who are under 2 years old is similar to the elderly. It's something we didn't really appreciate until the last 10 or 15 years. There's a substantial economic burden associated with influenza, and you can see the number, $87 billion in one recent study was estimated. Clinical diagnosis is important to think about because that's often how influenza is diagnosed. However, the clinical symptoms are nonspecific and they overlap with other pathogens, and this is the terminology often used for this is a person has influenza-like illness. So it could be caused by influenza, but could also be caused by other respiratory pathogens, particularly other respiratory viruses. You need laboratory data to verify the diagnosis of influenza. And even at peak influenza season, when a community is really getting walloped with influenza, you still see about 25 to 35% of specimens actually being positive for influenza. And so there's lots of other stuff out there, and it's important to keep in mind. Next slide, please. Laboratory testing for influenza virus is somewhat complicated and not available to some extent to the clinician at the bedside. Viral culture is the gold standard, but it takes 7 days usually. It's not going to be helpful in managing your patient, most likely. But the viral culture, from our perspective, is really important because it's the source of our viral strain surveillance and the reason that we know about antigenic drift and which strains should be in the vaccine and also the antiviral resistance. Serology is sometimes still used. You have to use paired serum samples, which means that you're going to take 2 weeks or more to get your diagnosis. Immunofluorescence is a good test, but it's somewhat user-dependent, and you need skill and experience in your laboratory to use it successfully. Reverse transcriptase polymerase chain reaction, or RT-PCR, is actually the most sensitive test available. It's becoming more widely available, in fact, and can even be used to distinguish influenza A subtype, but typically this can only be done at the state health laboratories or in some reference laboratories. Rapid antigen tests are really the mainstay of an influenza diagnosis, and I'll spend the next couple of slides talking about them because it's important to understand their uses and their potential pitfalls when you're interpreting the results from rapid antigen tests. So in most of the studies, including the licensure studies, these tests were 70-plus or more percent sensitive and 90% or more specific in children particularly. But it's actually probably a lot lower in terms of sensitivity in adults, maybe in more in the order of 50 to 60% in some recent studies. You can get results, however, from rapid antigen tests that, you know, understanding these shortfalls, these results are very useful from a clinical point of view because you can do the test in the clinic. You can get your result back in 30 minutes or less sometimes. Next slide, please. So again, expanding on the topic of rapid influenza diagnostic tests, the advantages to them are the speed at which they can be done and the ease of getting the specimen itself. They're useful for detecting outbreaks and for management. It's a simple procedure. Some of them can distinguish influenza A from B, and that's actually going to be important later on in the discussion. But not all those tests can. Some of the tests can only tell you influenza yes, no. The disadvantages are that they're less accurate than viral culture. Again, the problem with sensitivity, so the positive predictive value is going to be highest during peak influenza activity. And I'll expand on that in just a minute. You get limited information. You're not getting this virus itself, and so it doesn't do much in terms of surveillance for what strains are in the community. And none of these rapid tests that are currently available can distinguish which of the two influenza subtypes is present, and that's important because we only are seeing the oseltamivir resistance that I'll talk about later in one of the subtypes. Next slide, please. The predictive values of the screening tests for influenza viruses are shown on this slide. And you have to, when you're looking at predictive values, you have to take into account the prevalence of the disease. And so in times of high influenza prevalence, when there's a lot of influenza in the community at peak activity, the positive predictive value is high. If you have a positive, that's great. It's a pretty good chance that you have influenza on your hands. The negative predictive value, however, is lowest at this point. That's where that sensitivity problem comes in. You can have people who look as though they have influenza, who get a negative test, and in fact, a negative rapid test, and in fact, when you do a more sensitive test, a PCR or a culture or something like that, you might find out that they do actually have influenza. And so as a result, there are instances when clinicians might do a rapid test and end up treating someone as if they have influenza, even with a negative test, perhaps because that person's at high risk for complications, or perhaps because they're very sick, or they're just convinced it's influenza. During times of low influenza, the prevalence, the opposite is true. The positive predictive value is the lowest. You have to worry about false positives. Next slide, please. So during periods of high activity within the community, I mentioned that sometimes clinicians will rely on clinical diagnosis. And I told you the clinical diagnosis is not particularly sensitive and specific. However, if you're in a situation where you are convinced someone has influenza, they're a severely ill patient, or they're patients at higher risk for complications, you're going to treat anyway, you might go ahead and not even do a testing for influenza. Some clinicians do that, and I think it's perfectly defensible to go that way. And the rationale, of course, is that the predictive value of a negative test is low during the peak season. Next slide, please. The next two slides are going to summarize the most recent annual influenza recommendations by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. These recommendations for antiviral treatment are a lot more specific than they have been in the past. And this is this year's recommendations. And of course, with the resistance problem that we've seen, we've had to go and alter these recommendations. But going into the season, this is what we had in terms of influenza treatment and who should be considered for treatment. If possible, you want to treat within 48 hours because the effectiveness of initiating treatment more than 48 hours after the illness has started has not been established. Persons who should be considered for influenza treatment include the ones that you'd expect: persons hospitalized with lab-confirmed influenza, those with influenza pneumonia, those who have influenza and a bacterial co-infection, those at higher risk of complications, and then, of course, anyone who has a want or a need to reduce to try to reduce the duration or severity of their symptoms can be treated. So outpatients are perfectly legitimate to provide treatment for outpatients. Next slide, please. So persons for whom antiviral chemoprophylaxis should be considered are listed on this slide. And chemoprophylaxis is when you give an antiviral to someone who you think might be exposed to influenza or during a period in the community when there's lots of influenza going around and you can't or are not sure the vaccine worked or something like that. So this is given to a person before they're actually ill. Persons for whom you might consider giving chemoprophylaxis include those at higher risk for complications during the 2 weeks after vaccination if there's a lot of influenza in the community. Persons for whom the vaccine is contraindicated, that's a small group, but if it's a person at higher risk for complications, you might think about it. Family members or healthcare providers who are unvaccinated and likely to have ongoing exposure to persons at high risk. Persons at higher risk and their family members when strains in the community are not well matched to the vaccine strains, that might be a consideration for chemoprophylaxis in that situation. Persons with immune deficiencies or those who might not respond to vaccination. And finally, unvaccinated staff and persons during response to an outbreak in a closed setting. Next slide, please. So now a few words about antivirals for treatment or prevention of influenza. Next slide. The neuraminidase inhibitors have been the mainstay of influenza treatment and prevention over the influenza chemoprophylaxis, rather, over the last several seasons. The two ones that licensed in the U.S. are oseltamivir, trade name Tamiflu, and zanamivir, trade name Relenza. And these are used for the treatment and prevention of seasonal influenza A and B infections. I mentioned treatment should begin as soon as possible and that the benefits of treatment are only well shown if it started within 48 hours of onset. Next slide, please. This is a cartoon trying to break up all these text slides I'm throwing at you with a visual. This shows the mechanism of action of neuraminidase inhibitors. What they do is they attach to the neuraminidase protein on the outside of the virus and make it so that it can't release itself from the cell that is infected, and so it renders it unable to replicate further. Next slide, please. And as far as effectiveness in treating seasonal influenza, it has been shown in several nicely done randomized controlled trials that you can reduce the duration of symptoms by an average of 1 to 1.5 days if you give it within 2 days or 48 hours of illness onset. There have been other observational studies, again not randomized controlled trials, but observational studies, that showed there was some benefit even when treatment started more than 48 hours after onset. We have less information about these drugs' ability to reduce the risk of lower respiratory tract complications or pneumonia or hospitalization, but we have seen reductions in some studies, not randomized controlled trials, but some studies. And in fact, one recent observational study that I refer to at the bottom of the slide, published in Clinical Infectious Diseases last year, indicated that oseltamivir use could reduce mortality in hospitalized patients who had lab-confirmed influenza A, even if it started. I'll mention that in the next slide. But even if it started more than 48 hours after onset, and those results need to be confirmed. But I think people are a little bit more aggressive, as you would expect, in treating hospitalized patients, even if they have show up to the hospital more than 48 hours after onset. These inhibitors are effective in preventing seasonal influenza, and that's chemoprophylaxis I mentioned. You want to start within 48 hours of exposure. A randomized controlled trial shows 70 to 90% reductions in illness if it started at that point. And these are sometimes used given daily to persons at high risk for complications during the season, such as in a nursing home setting, and they are quite effective when used that way. Specifically talking about oseltamivir, it's available as a capsule or a suspension that's given by mouth. It's approved in the U.S. for persons 1 year of age and older. Treatment's for 5 days. The prevention regimen is for 10 days. You have to change the dosage according to pediatric considerations of age and weight. And side effects include nausea and vomiting in some persons. These are side effects that maybe occur in a few percentage of persons, less than 10%. The most serious side effect that people have been worrying about most recently, there were some reports of delirium in pediatric patients, particularly in adolescents. Most of these reports were from Japan. It's not entirely clear at this point whether these symptoms were due to influenza virus infection itself or due to the drug. However, a warning was added to the U.S. label in 2007. Warning clinicians to tell patients about this potential side effect and to monitor patients who are getting oseltamivir in this age group. People with kidney disease need to get their dosage reduced. I'm on the next slide, sorry, oseltamivir slide 2. And pregnant or nursing women, safety is unknown. There's not known to be any problem, but it's just the studies haven't been done. There is a resistance sometimes seen, which can develop during treatment. This actually, for the neuraminidase inhibitors, including oseltamivir, was quite low up until last season, and it typically was reported in persons, say, who are immunosuppressed, who are getting these long courses of treatment. So a little more about that in a minute. Zanamivir is the other neuraminidase inhibitor available. This is delivered in a different way. It's an orally inhaled powder that's given by a special device that I've shown in this picture here. I'm on the next slide, by the way. This is an Zanamivir slide. Sorry about that. It's approved in the U.S. For treatment of seasonal influenza if you're over age 7 or over, and for prevention of, treatment of seasonal influenza for 7 and over, prevention if for 5 and over. Now, the dosage for treatment is 2 puffs in the morning and 2 at night. The prevention dosage is 2 puffs once a day, and typically that's done for 10 days. Side effects include a low risk of wheezing and breathing problems. Because of concerns about reports of delirium associated with oseltamivir, and knowing that zanamivir was in the same class of drugs, there was a warning label added in 2008 with similar language as in the oseltamivir warning. There's a lot less data, I think, on delirium associated with zanamivir, but that does appear on the label. The second zanamivir slide I've just moved to, precautions include those with chronic respiratory disease, as you'd expect, because of the delivery system. Pregnant and nursing women, again, unknown of any problems, just that there's not been enough studies to say it's safe in this group. Resistance can develop during treatment, though again, rarely, and in persons who are getting prolonged courses of treatment. And there are, and I say this in the present tense now, there are very low levels of resistance among influenza A, H1, and H3 viruses. In fact, it's extremely rare. The next slide is not one I think I'm going to go through. I'm just going to refer you to this. This is the table that gives the dosages and the weight-based dosing and so on that appears in the annual recommendations. And you can download these from the CDC website if you'd like to look at them. They're a bit lengthy to go through. Next slide, please. There are other antivirals active against influenza A viruses, and these are antivirals that many of you might remember were commonly used before about 2006. And they're mantidine and rimantidine, collectively known as a class of drugs called adamantanes. They have a different mode of mechanism, mode of operation. They inhibit the function of the M2 ion channel in the influenza A virus and B virus, sorry. Not B virus. They don't have activity against B, sorry. Resistance develops rapidly within influenza A viruses. These were effective drugs, but we were much more concerned when we were using them about resistance developing over the course of treatment. At this point, and for the last several years, there's been a very high level of resistance among influenza A H3N2 viruses to the adamantanes. And for that reason, they actually were no longer recommended starting in 2006, and they are not recommended ever as a single agent for treatment. The important thing here at the bottom of the slide that I've mentioned is that there's no additional antivirals that are expected to be available in the near future. We have these four, and these are the four we'll have for this season and for the near term. Next slide, please. I'm going to explain to you just in a couple slides where we get our antiviral resistance data from. This is a schematic of all the different ways that information about influenza feeds into the CDC surveillance system and how we send it out to public health officials and physicians and the public and so on. The one I'm, of course, going to focus on is the laboratory part of it, and that's I've highlighted in red here. Next slide, please. This is a schematic, rather a graph, showing the number of virus isolates that came into CDC over the last season. And what you can see here is the virus isolation pattern mirrors what the season looks like. So week 40 is in September. That's at the left side of the x-axis there, and it goes right up through the end of the year and into the first couple months of the following year. And so we do a lot of testing, us in collaboration with all our WHO and NERVS labs, together tested 229,000 samples from persons with acute respiratory illness last year. Nearly 40,000 of them were positive for influenza. And it's broken down on these bars here according to which type of influenza it was positive for. And so you can see the red is influenza AH3, the blues are AH1, the Bs are green, and a number of these specimens don't actually end up getting typed. They're just influenza positive, yes or no. The inset with the pie graph there shows the proportion of viruses over the course of the season that were according to type or subtype. And so you can see from here about 60% or so of the viruses were H3N2s, about a third of them were B viruses, and then a little less than a quarter were influenza AH1s. Next slide, please. So during this season that I just showed you here, we saw the development of oseltamivir resistance among influenza A, H1N1 viruses. At the end of the season, when it was all tallied up, we'd had 123 of the 1,026 influenza A, H1N viruses tested had been resistant to oseltamivir, and that was almost 12% of viruses tested. And this compared to, from the previous season, only 0.7%, so quite a dramatic jump in resistance. However, because of the fact that we had mostly H3N2 and B viruses circulating in this past season, we only think about 2% of all the viruses, influenza viruses circulating, were resistant to oseltamivir. So from a clinical perspective, a fairly low chance of you running into a patient with a resistant influenza A, H1N1, last season. Worldwide, the prevalence of resistance was a little higher. At the end of the Northern Hemisphere season, about 16% of the 7,500 or so viruses tested were resistant to oseltamivir. And of all these viruses tested, influenza A H1N1s tested that were resistant, they all had the same genetic mutation, which is called H274Y for the amino acid that's replaced in the neuraminidase gene. So all the same looking virus. We did go back and look at patients who had infection with these oseltamivir-resistant viruses. In all cases, this was an incidental finding in the sense that the person that had, for whatever reason, a sample taken, it got sent to the lab, it got to us, it got antiviral resistance testing, and lo and behold, it was resistant. At that point, the patient had long since recovered from their illness, and their illness, as best we could tell, didn't look any different from the illness caused by oseltamivir-sensitive viruses. So amongst the 99 patients with influenza that we were able to follow up on that had influenza A H1N1 that was resistant to oseltamivir, none of them had actually been taking oseltamivir before they got tested, and none of them had had contacts taking oseltamivir. And when we compared to the oseltamivir-sensitive illnesses, the illnesses caused by oseltamivir-sensitive influenza A viruses, the clinical illness, the severity of the illness, and the type of persons who were getting ill really looked about the same. So for all intents and purposes, this looked like influenza A H1N1 infection, just whether or not it was resistant or sensitive to oseltamivir. The European Union did some similar looking into their data. They also thought that oseltamivir use was not the cause of increases in resistance. They saw, in general, the same clinical characteristics for persons with oseltamivir-sensitive viruses, similar to our findings in the U.S., and you can see these summarized on the EU website. Next slide, please. So, where are we now? This is just getting to the start of the 2008-2009 season. I wanted to give you a summary of where we are with antiviral resistance and then summarize the guidelines. Next slide, please. So at this point, we actually do not have, in most communities, much in the way of influenza activity. It's been a pretty slow start to the season. As a result, we don't have a lot of viruses available for antiviral testing. Since October 1st, we've been able to get viruses from 21 states, including 73 influenza A H1N1s, 11 H3N2s, and 33 Bs. 58% of these influenza A viruses tested were only from three states, so a lot of activity from three states only. So we don't have a very good representative sample from across the U.S. at this point, just because there hasn't been enough activity. Next slide, please. Sorry, I've had a glitch in my computer here. I'm having trouble advancing my own slides. Okay, so here we are. We've moved to the next slide, which has a map of the U.S., and this shows the influenza activity, just underscoring what I was saying. Local activity has been reported in, it looks like, about six or seven states there scattered around. There is some regional activity, the next level up of activity in three states, but most states either have no activity or sporadic activity, and you can see the key at the bottom. And I've pulled this slide directly from the weekly update that CDC has on their website. So if you want to follow this yourself, you can go to that website I've listed at the bottom of the slide and look at the publication called FluView, and this will give you a lot of information about influenza there. This also can be obtained from FluView. This is our surveillance where we look at influenza-like illnesses from a system of about 2,500 Sentinel providers, that is providers who have agreed to tell us how many persons come into their office each week with an influenza-like illness. You can see the last two seasons in the green and the blue, where you see a blip up above the national baseline late in the year, and then at the beginning, at the start of the next year, a pretty good peak, just as typical as in the influenza season. In the red there, you see tracked what we have so far this year, and you can see we really haven't got up above the baseline this year, just again emphasizing we don't have a lot of influenza activity yet, and as a result, we don't have a whole lot of viruses to test. Next slide, please. Of the viruses we have tested, though, here are the results. So of the influenza A H1N1s, we've had 73 viruses that have gotten antiviral testing. 72 out of the 73, and that's no need to tell you that that's going to be well over 95%, were resistant to oseltamivir. All of those oseltamivir-resistant viruses were sensitive to zanamivir. In fact, all of the influenza A viruses were sensitive to zanamivir. Among the H3N2 viruses, we have very little H3N2 activity so far. All 11 tested were sensitive to both of the neuraminidase inhibitors, as they have been in past seasons. All the B viruses were also sensitive to both of the neuraminidase inhibitors, oseltamivir and zanamivir. As far as adamantane resistance, which we are quite interested in again, of course, of the 73 H1N1s and H3N2 viruses that were tested, all the influenza A H1N viruses were sensitive to amantadine and rimantadine. And I should note that H1N1s are not always sensitive to these drugs. It just happens that these resistant these viruses resistant to oseltamivir appear to be sensitive to the adamantanes. All of the H3N2s, however, were resistant to the adamantanes. And those adamantane drugs, amantadine and rimantadine, are not effective against influenza B. We don't even test them. So here's a grid kind of summarizing these results. And what you can see if you look at the rows, there's really only a zanamivir where you can reliably say that an influenza strain is susceptible. So you have resistance to oseltamivir in the H1N1s, you have resistance to the adamantanes in the H3N2s and the Bs. Next slide, please. So in summary, resistance probably developed as part of the antigenic drift process and not driven by oseltamivir use. And in fact, we have some indirect evidence for that. Japan uses a lot of oseltamivir, it's sort of a different clinical way of practicing there in terms of influenza. And they have about 75% of the world's oseltamivir use, but oddly enough, they have a low prevalence of resistance. In the converse is true in Norway, which doesn't use a lot of oseltamivir, but was the first country to report much resistance, and at the end of last season even already had 70% resistance to oseltamivir among their H1N1s. There's no evidence, as I stated before, just to summarize, there's no evidence that these oseltamivir-resistant viruses are different in any clinically important way from the oseltamivir-sensitive viruses, at least in data obtained in the U.S. So there's implications for clinical management, and this is what led us to issue the interim guidelines. There's no test for antiviral resistance available to a person at the bedside. There are rapid tests that can distinguish influenza A from B. However, there's no rapid test that can distinguish H3N2 from H1N1. That's called subtyping, although some state health laboratories and reference labs can do it. Empiric treatment is often used when influenza activity is high. And finally, many clinicians don't actually use antivirals, we know that from results of surveys and from looking at medical records of patients who have had laboratory-confirmed influenza. There actually is not that much antiviral use going on out there among patients with influenza anyway. However, we were concerned going into the season that clinicians who do use antivirals for treatment and chemoprophylaxis would want to be updated on resistance issues and have some options if resistance developed, as it turned out to have developed. So we worked with the state health labs to enhance our viral surveillance system to try to get more representative samples of viruses from across the U.S. We've worked on increasing our ability to do antiviral resistance testing. We discussed some of the response scenarios with consultants and with the ACIP work group. During the season so far to date, we had an update in December 2008 of influenza activity. We have the flu view I mentioned earlier, which is updated every week, every Friday. We discussed these issues with the manufacturers, the neuraminidase inhibitors, and we developed the draft Health Alert Network Advisory, which we refer to as the HAN, H-A-N, that had these interim guidelines. Next slide, please. And these last couple slides will run us through the interim guidelines and where they stand now. They look complicated, but I think if you think it through, that you actually can probably predict the choices that we are suggesting. Next slide, please. So this is the first text slide here of the interim guidance, and these are just kind of the three main points out of the guidance. First is that early season data indicates that oseltamivir-resistant H1N1 is the most commonly isolated virus so far. I showed you the numbers before. Not only are they almost all resistant, but H1N1 is also the most common virus at this point in the season. Clinicians need to know oseltamivir alone might not effectively prevent or treat influenza if there's a lot of H1N1 in the community. And the Health Alert Network Advisory, or the HAN, is the focus of the next few slides. The bottom line here is that treatment with the zanamivir or a combination of oseltamivir and rimantadine might be preferable in some situations. You can use local influenza surveillance data if you have it. You can use laboratory testing, the rapid antigen test, to help with the decision-making regarding the choice of antiviral agents for patients. And finally, oseltamivir-resistant H1N1 strains are antigenically similar or identical to the strains in the vaccine. And the implication of this is that the vaccine should be capable of preventing illness with the oseltamivir-resistant strains because it's very similar to the strain that's in the vaccine. And that's somewhat in contrast to what we saw last season, where we had a lot of mismatch between the strains in the vaccine and the strains that were circulating. We could still have that in the future. We're early in the season, but thus far, all signs are good in terms of having a year that has a good match to the circulating strain. Next slide, please. So, let's expand on these points a little bit more. You can use influenza virus testing to help with decision making. For example, a rapid test that can distinguish influenza A from influenza B is useful. If a patient tests positive for B, you don't have to worry about oseltamivir resistance. You can use oseltamivir or zanamivir, and there's no preference and no change for treatment of influenza B infections because we haven't seen oseltamivir resistance among these viruses. Next slide, please. So you can also review your local or your state influenza virus surveillance data during the influenza season and to see if you can get some sense of which viruses are circulating in the area. Again, state health laboratories do have the capacity and do subtyping of influenza viruses, and they could potentially provide this data, and it could be useful. However, realistically speaking, because influenza is so variable, it can be variable across states and even within communities, there are going to be some instances in some communities where there's just not enough information available, and it's just not timely enough to be that useful to clinicians. We recognize that, but if that data is available, you can put it to good use. Next slide, please. So we have sort of laid out the various scenarios here in the next three slides in a grid form. And the four columns are the results of the rapid antigen or the other laboratory test, the predominant viruses in the community, the preferred medications, and the alternative medication, which is typically going to be combination treatment. So this first slide here goes through the scenario if you've not been able to do testing, or the testing's negative, but you really think this might be influenza. Now, suppose the predominant virus in the community is unknown to you, or you happen to know it's H1N1. The best medication in that instance to use is probably going to be zanamivir, but as we'll discuss in a minute, there are lots of people who can't take zanamivir. There may be issues with availability. In that case, an alternative regimen would include a combination of two antivirals. That is oseltamivir, which would be treating the H3N2s and the B viruses, and rimantadine, which would be treating the H1N1 viruses. So you need them both. They're not acting in a synergistic way. They're acting in sort of a complementary way, with one of them, rimantadine, hitting the H1N1s, and oseltamivir, the other, hitting the Bs and the H3N2s. The second row in this slide, again, goes through the scenario of no test available or a clinical suspicion of flu. However, this time you have access to the information about viruses in the community, and it looks like it's an H3N2 or a B part of the season. In that case, it's reasonable to go with either oseltamivir or zanamivir, and in that case you don't need to worry about combination treatment. It's important to know, and I've put a little footnote here, we don't have a lot of clinical experience with combination treatment. There's no reason to think there should be issues with safety, but it's just not well studied, and it's important to keep in mind when you're using combination treatment. Next slide, please. So here we have another scenario, and that is that you do have a rapid antigen test or some other laboratory test available to you that tells you that you have an influenza A virus. And remember, you're not likely going to be able to get subtyping available at the bedside. Now you look at your local surveillance data, and you find you really can't tell, or you know that you have H1N1. Here again, you're going to want to look for zanamivir as the one drug, if you want to use a single drug, the one drug that would get all of the potential influenza viruses that might be circulating. And again, combination treatment with oseltamivir or rimantadine is an alternative. Suppose you have a positive rapid antigen test for influenza A, but you know there's H3N2 or B in the community. Here is an instance where you might use oseltamivir or zanamivir without any preference. Next slide, please. Okay, in the last three situations here, you have a rapid antigen test, and it's one of those tests that can't tell you the difference between A and B. If you know there's H1N1 or unknown in the community, again, and I'm sure you're going to be able to predict these pretty soon, the preferred medication in that case is going to be zanamivir, with the alternative being the combination of oseltamivir or rimantadine. If you have an AB positive test and you have H3N2 or B, in that case, oseltamivir or zanamivir could be used. And of course, as we mentioned before, if you have a positive influenza B test, then it really doesn't matter what the viruses are in the community. You can use oseltamivir or zanamivir. Next slide, please. So chemoprophylaxis issue is actually a little bit more complicated, and it can't really be easily kind of gamed out in these scenarios like treatment can. This is the kind of thing that you likely are going to want to consult with your local or state health department if you have an outbreak situation. But here I've just listed a couple of key points about chemoprophylaxis in this era of antiviral resistance among H1N1s. Obviously, you want to use chemoprophylaxis. It's most likely to be effective against in preventing treatment with the influenza viruses that are the cause of the outbreak, if you know it. If you have an institutional outbreak, it's great to you have perhaps a little bit more time in this situation. And you have a lot more people that you're talking about putting on chemoprophylaxis, so you would do well to do your best efforts to get a respiratory specimen and see if you can't get the type and subtype of influenza A so that you can specifically tailor chemoprophylaxis and specifically tailor treatment if anybody has a breakthrough infection. If the person who needs chemoprophylaxis has an exposure to a person that you know had lab-confirmed H3N2 or influenza B, you can use oseltamivir or zanamivir, no preference. You suspect you know what that person is, what you're trying to prevent in that person in that case. You can use zanamivir. It can be used for chemoprophylaxis when a person needs chemoprophylaxis against exposure to influenza A, H1N1. Rimantadine is a potential alternative if the person can't take zanamivir. There might be some situations where you need to use oseltamivir and rimantadine for chemoprophylaxis. To reduce the need for combination therapy and rather prophylaxis, and as I mentioned, we don't have a lot of clinical experience with this, it's a good idea to look for subtyping and determine if it's an influenza A, H3N2, or H1N1. And if it's an H1N1, you might even be able to get your state lab or have your state lab send to CDC the virus isolate for antiviral testing. Next slide, please. Now, I mentioned some challenges associated with zanamivir use, and there are three main ones. One is this method of administration. It's an inhaled medication. Severely ill patients might not be able to take it. The age limitations, I mentioned, it can't be given to small children. It's contraindicated for patients with pulmonary disease, and it's hard to administer to a hospitalized patient. Clinicians have not used a lot of zanamivir in the past, partly due to this third reason here, because of relatively reduced availability. So clinicians might not be familiar with zanamivir, but this would be a good season to develop familiarity. We have spoken to the manufacturer of zanamivir. They have greatly increased the supply available for 2008-2009. Of course, we haven't had much activity yet to really test this, but we have not heard about people having trouble getting zanamivir at this point. Next slide, please. So just the last few slides to wrap this up, to sum up and also describe to you what you might see from CDC or elsewhere regarding antiviral resistance over the course of the next few months. Next slide, please. So I mentioned that during the season so far, we've enhanced our viral surveillance. We have the MMWR came out in December 2008. We had the HAN that came out. We've had ongoing discussions with the manufacturers, and we've developed a communication strategy, and there's lots of information on antiviral resistance now available on the CDC web. And those websites, I think, appeared in earlier slides. Now, what you might expect coming up, you're going to keep seeing the flu view every week, every Friday. We'll update it with all sorts of different data about influenza activity, including antiviral resistance. There's a scheduled MMWR in February 2009. There always is one in February 2009, but this will, of course, cover influenza activity, but we're obviously going to need to devote some time to the issue of resistance. Another one coming out in April 2009. There's the potential for additional guidelines based on emerging surveillance data. There's going to be a full ACIP meeting, a previously scheduled meeting. It's their thrice yearly meeting. The next one is in February 2009, where there will be some discussion of antiviral resistance. The annual recommendations, which are voted on at that meeting, typically contain information about recommendations for antivirals. It's possible this year they might split off that piece of the recommendations, awaiting to see what happens with the rest of the influenza season. And, of course, CDC and the health departments will be monitoring for severe infections or for outbreaks, unusual outbreaks that involve oseltamivir-resistant viruses. So just to leave you with a little bit of good news, though, so far we also here at CDC do antigenic characterization. What this means is we look at the similarity between the circulating strains in the communities and the similarity to the strains represented in the vaccine. And as I mentioned, so far this season, the influenza A H1N1s that have been antigenically characterized are very similar. In fact, all of them are 100% similar. 100% of them are similar, rather, to the vaccine strain that's called A Brisbane 59. We don't have many H3s characterized yet, only 7 of them. However, all of them are similar to the vaccine strain. The B viruses are always problematic because there are 2 distinct types of influenza B virus that circulate. There's only 1 type represented in the vaccine. This year, 33% of the 27 B viruses characterized are similar to the vaccine strain. Next slide, please. So, just to sum it up, we are continuing to actively test viruses to monitor antiviral resistance through the season. Viruses that are sensitive to, that are resistant to oseltamivir are sensitive to zanamivir and adamantanes, that is the influenza A H1N1s that we've been talking about. Those influenza A H1N1 viruses that are resistant to oseltamivir do not appear to be more dangerous or infectious in any way. They look just like a regular flu virus in terms of the clinical appearance. Next slide, please. You're going to need to, it's going to be a little complicated making decisions about antiviral treatment this season. You're going to need to look at, if you have it available to you, local surveillance data, use your clinical judgment, and rapid antigen testing to guide your choice of antiviral regimen. Be alert for changes in antiviral recommendations. We'll update these as we need to. I don't foresee any updates in the future, and as I mentioned, we have a fairly limited armamentarium available to us to change antiviral recommendations at this point. Keep alert. We'll try to release any information we think might be useful to clinicians and public health officials as soon as we get it. And finally, the final bullet here is the vaccination prevents influenza. As far as we can tell, vaccination should prevent infections due to these oseltamivir-resistant strains. And the last slide, and this is just a recap of what happened last season, just to help you keep in mind that the viruses that are most common in the communities change over the course of time. So right now we are seeing a lot of H1N1, and almost all that H1N1 is resistant to oseltamivir. Well, let's go back in time and look at the previous influenza season, the 2007-08 season. Now, going into January, H1N1s were most common last season also, and they're represented here in the red blocks. However, by February, the H1N1s had kind of faded out, and the other 2 viruses had overtaken them in terms of prevalence. So the B viruses here are represented by the green blocks, and the H3N2 viruses are represented by the yellow blocks. And as I showed you earlier in the slide presentation, we really had an H3N2 and a B year. So it might be that in a few weeks from now, H1N1s could reduce in prevalence, and this issue of antiviral resistance might become less of a pressing issue. But let's see what happens. And the season is just getting underway, and with that, I'll wrap up the talk and take questions, and please do let me know about issues you have with the interim guidelines or any sources of confusion in particular I'd be interested to know about. Thanks very much.
Yes, thank you. To ask a question, please press *1. When prompted, clearly record your first and last name. To withdraw your question, please press *2. We'll now take a moment for questions. First question comes from Dr. Frank Tortonella. So your line is open.
Yes. Healthcare workers, direct healthcare workers who have not taken flu vaccine yet, if they are exposed to a patient with flu A, is the recommendation to use the antivirals for 10 or 14 days, assuming you can get them to take a vaccination at the same time you start them on the antivirals?
Sorry. I think you can just use it for 10 days as a typical regimen, just given the incubation period. Are you talking about specific exposure or just the community outbreak started and you think they're getting exposed every day in the clinic potentially?
Specific exposures.
Okay.
Starting them within 48 hours, but also trying to get them then, those who have not taken it yet, to take a vaccine. So you would use 10 days of the antiviral, get them vaccinated.
Right.
And so a 10. That's the question. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Hamish Aldaza. So your line is open.
I had a question regarding the availability of rapid typing. There was a paper in, I think, the Journal of Virologic Methods regarding rapid typing to tell the neuraminidase type, and I was wondering if CDC has any plans to trial that in emergency rooms or clinics so that we would have real-time resistance data.
Well, we have, there are two PCR-based tests that can do subtyping that have become available in this last year. One of them is the Luminex platform, and the other is a platform, I'm actually not even sure what the trade name of it is, but CDC helped develop it. And the state health labs have these, and some reference labs do have these at this point. In fact, we actually don't really know how many labs might have the capacity to do this. It might be that some of your bigger academic centers might have a Luminex platform and be able to give you subtype information. As far as the rapid antiviral resistance testing goes, I don't see that. I don't know the plans for trying to get that out into the community at this point. I think it's thought to not be ready yet from our perspective, but I'm not one of the virologists. So it's not going to help you this season, I guess I could put it that way. But obviously that with this level of resistance arising to something like this, that there certainly will be increasing pressure to see such a test get out there more quickly perhaps than it had been in the past, had been planned.
Because technically all you need to know is the N1 or the N2 type, and then you could make your decision based upon that on your antiviral treatment. You wouldn't need to know if it was actually resistant or not based on the data from this season.
Yes, right. And so for those two tests that can give you H3N2 versus H1N1, which I think you might actually be referring to as specific neuraminidase tests, which I don't know much about, but it's sort of the same situation. Yeah, if you can get a hold of that, that's great. I don't think a specific neuraminidase typing test is commercially available. I don't know the timeline for getting it out there.
Our next question comes from Henry Nyman. So your line is open.
Hello. There were a couple reports that just came out of the NIH in Japan regarding outbreaks in elementary schools. One, I think, closed 10 schools in Sendai, and they released some of the sequence data. They were oseltamivir resistant, and in fact, they had the identical changes that were seen in Hawaii, Pennsylvania, and Texas here in the United States. And I was wondering if the CDC would have a good representation in their surveillance for elementary school students.
Well, we do worry about a representation amongst children, because I think our virus surveillance is based on a person going to a doctor who submits a specimen to the one of the collaborating labs, and if kids tend to get less severe infection, which sometimes they do, compared to the elderly, for example, we might not get as many specimens from children. It's a concern when we say we have X percent of resistance. I think you just have to keep in mind that we may not. Well, two things. One is we may not have as broad a swath of the population represented in our viral surveillance. But the second thing is from community to community, the variation is great, and so. There may be communities out there that, for example, I'm sure there would be communities out there that don't see any H1N1 this year at all. That's just how they'll just see B and H3N2, or just how it works out. So we don't have a specific system for getting to the short answer to your question. Is we don't have a specific system for linking in with outbreaks associated with elementary schools, with the exception of if the state health department is interested in it and goes out, swabs and throats and sends it in which case we do get it.
Our next question comes from Dr. Chai. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for taking my phone call. One of your slides titled Challenges Associated with Zanamivir Use, it stated that it was contraindicated for patients with pulmonary disease, and we see a lot of students with asthma. So just wanted to clarify that we don't give Zanamivir to patients with asthma, and also there are even some students that come in without a diagnosis of asthma in the past, and I hear wheezing. So for those individuals, I would not prescribe Zanamivir if their test was positive for flu. Is that right?
Yeah, it could be problematic. I mean, if you're spraying a powder into their upper airways, and it definitely could elicit some bronchospasm. So the most of these bronchospasm instances in the trials, at least, were pretty minor. So this is a sort of a judgment call. If you really would rather not give the child a combination therapy, if you have a positive flu test, you know, with caution, you can try the Zanamivir. But in general, people shy away from using Zanamivir in persons with bronchospasm.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Our next question is from Melody Mozoon. Ma'am, your line is open.
Yes, I'm fortunate to live in a community where actually part of a surveillance system to send samples to you, which fortunately we have pediatric samples too. And I'm also in a community where viral subtyping is likely to be available, you know, within a week or two of the epidemic reaching its peak anyway. So my question is, on your chart, you have positive A, H1N1, or unknown, and the alternative treatment for pediatric patients who can't take Zanamivir for age or bronchospasm is a combination. And I'm wondering, if we're pretty certain that H1N1 is what's circulating, can we just use Rimantadine? Because both of those medications have CNS effects that can be pretty remarkable in pediatric patients. So using a combination that, you know, might both cause hallucinations or whatever would be pretty unpopular for families.
Right. We struggled with this. I mean, I think there is a real lack of enthusiasm about using Rimantadine alone as treatment because of the fairly rapid development of resistance that's mm-hmm. seen. It's different from the resistance you see in neuraminidase inhibitors after a sort of a prolonged treatment. You can pretty quickly see resistant viruses in persons that get Rimantadine. Here's a good example. You actually have sort of a Cadillac version of surveillance, it sounds like.
Right.
I think there's a lot of leeway for clinical judgment here, and I think, you know, Rimantadine might be a reasonable choice if you're quite certain that you're, well, not quite certain, but reasonably certain that you have H1N1 that you're dealing with. But I think the important thing, though, also to keep in mind is that H1N1s have been resistant in past seasons to Rimantadine. It's not nearly the high level you see in H3N2s, but you know, 10 to 20% of H1N1s in most of the past couple of seasons have been resistant. It just so happens this H1N1 we're seeing now is sensitive, but one could easily imagine the resistance pattern flipping. If a new H1N1 comes through, it might be then sensitive to oseltamivir, yet resistant to Rimantadine. So if you do elect to go with Rimantadine alone, I think you'll need to keep on top of the antiviral resistance data also, which might be a little harder to do.
Thank you.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Our next question is from Dr. Jim Turner. Sir, your line is open.
Hi, Tony. Jim Turner from the University of Virginia. Thank you very much for an excellent presentation. I was curious to know of the 99 patients you cited earlier who had influenza from the oseltamivir-resistant strains. Did any of them get treated with oseltamivir, and was there evidence that the resistance really was impacted their ability to respond to the drug or their clinical outcome?
Jim, thanks for that question. I wish I had the paper in front of me right now, or at least the draft of the paper. As I recall, only a handful of folks got oseltamivir treatment. The fact that the virus was resistant was discovered, you know, weeks after the person got ill, and a number of these were young persons, children who often don't get treatment at all. So I'm pretty confident that only a few of them got oseltamivir treatment. So I don't think we have enough to say that the drug might have actually helped them despite the in vitro finding of resistance.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question comes from Dr. Frank Tortorella. Sir, your line is open.
Thank you. Another question about chemoprophylaxis and healthcare workers who still choose not to take a vaccine. If you can get them onto the antivirals within 48 hours of exposure, how long would you have to continue to prevent that specific exposure? Was 5 days adequate, 7 days adequate, or would you have to still use that 10-day protocol?
I think the 10-day protocol is what I would use.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Henry Nyman. Sir, your line is open.
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment regarding the adamantane resistance and the likelihood that that's going to appear in the United States this season. Last season, the resistance really segregated out. And there's a class 2B and a class 2C. The Brisbane is 2B. And that was sensitive, and the 2C was 100% resistant. Most of the 2C was in Asia, and in the United States, it was mostly in the western states like Hawaii or California. This season, there does not seem to be any of that circulating here, and it also doesn't seem to be circulating in Asia. Japan just has the 2B. And so the 2B with the oseltamivir resistance seems to have taken over, and the 2C is fading away. So the chance that there'll be remantidine resistance this season is probably pretty low.
Okay, thanks. You sound like you're well informed in the virology of this, probably more than me. You're likely right. It might be not till next season, if at all, that we see those H1N1s that are resistant to rimantidine show back up. I bet it'll happen eventually, thanks for the comment. I think it's we're both speculating. It sounds like you have a good basis for the speculation.
Okay, thank you.
I show no further questions in queue at this time.
Well, I want to thank Dr. Fiore for this very timely update and for providing our listeners with this information. So if you have another question or if you think of one later, please always feel free to email coca@coca@cdc.gov, and we'll try to get an answer to you as soon as possible. The recording of this call and the transcript will be posted to the COCA website at www.emergency.cdc.gov/COCA within the next week. You have 1 year to obtain continuing education credits for this call. All continuing education credits for COCA conference calls are issued online through the CDC Training and Continuing Education Online System at www.2a.cdc.gov/TCEonline. Thanks again for participating, and have a wonderful day.